Right. Welcome, welcome to everybody for our webinar today from the British Institute of Persian Studies. My colleague, Dr. Said Talajoy from the University of St. Andrews, is going to present on reformulation of the ideals of heroism in Bahram Bezai's Dramatic Worlds. Said Talajoy is a senior lecturer in Persian at the University of St. Andrews. His research is on the reflections of the changing patterns of Iranian identity in Persian literature and Iranian cinema and theater. His most recent publications include a monograph entitled Iranian Culture and Bahram Bezai's Cinema and Theater, Paradigms of Being and Belonging, which is 2023 from IB Taurus, an edited volume entitled The Plays and Films of Bahram Bezai, Origins, Forms, and Functions, 2024, and two books, which in each case include a translation of a play by the author and its analysis, The 1001st Night and Afra, or The Day is Passing. And without further ado, I'm going to hand over to you, Said. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew, for your introduction. So today, hello, everyone. Happy Nowruz to everybody. I almost forgot. And what I'm going to do today is that I'm going to talk about a reformulation of the ideals of heroism in Bahram Bezai's early plays, Arash and Soda-i Pahlavan. Soda-i Pahlavan Akbar. In the course of my talk, I also refer to some of his other plays, but the focus will be these two plays. These two chapters are parts of the book that I recently published, the edited volume on Bahram Bezai. The edited volume has four sections, and one section, which has two chapters, has been focused on Bahram Bezai's early plays. And the other sections of the book, three of the articles are about texts and context, whether the political context or the cultural context or the dialogue of Bahram Bezai, for instance, with Institute of Intellectual Development of Children and Young Adults for the productions of films like Uncle Mustache, A Journey, or Bashu, the Little Stranger. And then the other section, section three is on genres and techniques. One of them deals with the way Bahram Bezai uses Tazir for his films, and it is focused on Bahram Bezai's travelers. And the other one is focused on how Bahram Bezai uses crime thriller elements in his city films. And the last section of the book is focused on the comparative context of Bahram Bezai's work. One of them is focused on multilinguality and Iranian cinema, for which Bashu was one of the most important early films. And the other one is on the depictions of children in Iranian cinema. So why heroes? So the question that I asked when I started studying Bahram Bezai is that I noticed that his early works are characterized by a direct focus on who is a hero and how that hero becomes a hero. And I asked myself, why do we have these elements? Why do we have so many questionings about heroism? And I noticed that a number of other people had written about heroes in that period. We are talking about serious plays. We are not talking about popular films or popular plays. But only one or two. But Bahram Bezai goes to the heart of the question from the beginning, systematically, first dealing with mythical heroes, then dealing with folk heroes, particularly folk heroes appearing in Taqlid or appearing, for instance, in Khayme Shabbazi, and then dealing with the ideals of heroism as reflected in the Zurkhane cult. So he moves from myth to folk tradition and romances and comes to the early 20th century, or late 19th century, the pre-moment of modernity. And the way he manages this subject is that he questions many of the givens of the ideals of heroism and gradually changes the idea of how a hero becomes a hero in his books. Why is the subject important? One of the first thing that I found was that it had a bit to do with the rise of the nationalistic discourses of the late 19th century and early 20th century, in which one of the ideals of nationalism referred to Iran as a mother. So the mother Iran and the sons of the mother's Irans, the men and the women of this country are supposed to be those who are intellectually or physically gifted, are supposed to support and serve this mother to make a more advanced country in a way to help the mother become better. This was one of the ideals that evolved in the late 19th century and became central for a period in 20th century. Of course, it had its own rivals, so we don't want to talk about the rivaling discourses of the left, Islamists or royalists, but this was one of the ideals that constitutionalists particularly really liked when it came to the folk traditions and folk histories and the way they communicated their feelings about the country. Another aspect was that Iranian heroism has always been important in Iranian cultural products, all right? So we have the Mithraic tradition, which has a long history, has been reflected in many of the epic works. We have the Ayin-e Javanmardi, or the cult of Javanmardi cults, different types, Ayyari cults, Pahlavani cults, all of them are interrelated. And then we have the epics and romances in which some of these have been reflected. Then we have the cult of Zurkhane that has continued to the present, but it was in full bloom in the early 20th century and produced many different types of characters and figures. And among those characters and figures, some of them were just streetwise thugs. And these thugs, whether they were called Dashmashtis, or whether they were called Jahels, these are some of the figures that gradually changed with time to become more modern and adapt themselves to the realities of Iranian society in the 20th century. The Dashmashti type, therefore, could be a luti or a lout, could be a destroyer or a creator or supporter, depending on the type of character that represented. Historically speaking, the last part was in most cases a troublemaker rather than a supporter and protector. So exceptions always existed. Some of the Dashmashti types were good people, all right? So we don't want to get to that. But then at the same time, the 1930s and 1940s are characterized by an abundance of American Hollywood films coming into Iran and being seen by many people, but particularly by these streetwise types of guys who really were among the first people who loved cinema. And this period is the heyday of what we call the sword and sandal films of the 1930s and 1960s, which corresponded to some of the ideals of heroism that appeared in Iranian epics and romances. So Iranians really liked them, and this type of people also liked them. And also we had the heydays of Western and gangster films. And we know that chivalry cults in Iran have always been important to different categories of people, maybe to the type that we call Dashmashti. They were claimed to be central to their lives, but in any case, they imitated those figures. In a way, the role models were always those who represented the cults of chivalry in Iran. But if you go to Western films, or you go to sword and sandal films, or even gangster films, you see that some of those chivalrous qualities appear in the top figures, in the heroic figures, in the central figures. So the evolution of the new ideal of Jaheli or Dashmashti type happened in the 1930s and 1940s, and the Kolam Ahmadi type was created in that period. And this is important because earlier, when we see the earlier reflections of this type in Iranian theater, for instance, we see that the type is almost always negative, but sometimes the type appears to support the hero, and sometimes the type appears to make trouble, is a troublemaker. So in any case, the central figure was never the tough guy until 1953. So following the coup, which has its own political aspects, and the involvement of many tough guys in the streetwise conflicts, in the street conflicts, we see the rise of attention to this figure. Some argue that this was because the Iranian political system wanted to, in a way, pay respect to the type that supported it. But some people say that the reason why they appeared was that nobody else could become hero and nobody else could be criticized. Therefore, the type gradually became central to Iranian cultural production in that period. And the first that we see is a novel by Hossein Madani called Esmal in New York, yeah, Esmal in New York. Esmal is the short form or Jahili form of Esmail. And then we have Esmal in India, Both of these were first published in newspapers and as installments, and then they were compiled in books between 1953 and 1955. And first it was Smolder, New York. I haven't read Smolder, Henderson, but I have read Smolder, New York, and I can tell you that it was funny. And what is important about it is that Madani does try to modernize the figure by exposing them to foreign cultures, and at the same time celebrates the Iranian culture by putting some of the good qualities of the Iranian masculinity type in the figure of Esmal, at the same time questioning some of the things that he does and some of the things that he believes in. And what happened then was that this figure gradually began to appear in Iranian cinema. Hossein Madani himself became a major screenwriter in the 1950s and 1960s, and then other people also got involved. One of the first films that focused on the figure of the luti, or the figure of the istash mashti type, was Majid Mohseni's Lata Jawan Mard, or The Shiverless Lad, which it was a very special film. It had good qualities because it tried to infuse the ideas of honor and kindness and compassion into the heart of this type of figures who frequented Iranian cinemas. So it had, at the same time that it celebrated them, it celebrated a particular type to try to change them into something better, with some modern qualities, but at the same time rooted and authentic in the way they understood Iranian culture. Later, of course, it began to branch into different fields, and this tough guy, Kolam Mahmadi type, and some other tough guys who were similar, became central to Iranian cinema. So this is why a person like Bahman Forsi or a person like Bahram Beyzai began to deal with the subject of who is a hero and whether we need a hero or not, or a people who needs heroes are actually weak people. And a citizen, if our people achieve the level of citizenship, they do not need a hero. These are some of the questions that you see in Bahram Beyzai's plays too. Bahman Forsi only wrote one play, but Beyzai, as I said earlier, did it systematically, moved along from the myth to the present time, to the Zurhana time. But again, what is important about what Beyzai did was that at the same time that he focused on who is a hero and how that figure becomes a hero, he focuses on reformulating Iranian performing traditions for the purpose. So in Arash, which was a recitation play, the term recitation play is my translation of the term Barkhani, which Beyzai created for his reformulation of Nakhbadi. So when he deals in his plays, in his early plays, he deals with heroism in the mythical context, he uses Nakhbadi. And the term is Barkhani for one, two, three, or more reciters. And he produced three plays in that tradition: Arash, the physical hero; Ajdahak, the figure of difference, the one that confronts Jamshid and becomes, or is assumed to be evil, but he's not actually evil in Bahram Beyzai's play. In Bahram Beyzai's plays, he's a marginalized person who is depicted as evil, and he never does any of the things that he has been said to have done. In a way, he is a figure that is created to justify the power of the center. And then we have the account of Bondar, the premier, in which we talk about heroes of intellectuality, which I don't want to deal with here, but it's a very important play, that one too. But in any case, in these three plays, Beyzai dealt with Naqali and transformed Naqali into a more dramatic form. One of the things that I do in this chapter is to deal with the origin of the myth of Arash, because myth of Arash is very special in that it doesn't appear in the Shahnameh, but it came to play an important role in Iranian culture during the 20th century, particularly in the 1950s, and I will tell you why. So the myth of Arash appears in Tir Yasht. It's a very short one, but in that Yasht, what happens is that the figure is a sacrificial figure who is helped by gods to reclaim Iranian lands which have fallen into the hands of demons, into the hands of a destroyer. When you look at the structure of this myth and the way it is presented, what you see as an agricultural myth, which has been repurposed for the celebration of Arsaci. This is, of course, my argument. So if you look at the structure, what you discover is that it has links with the Indo-Iranian legend of Erekhsha, which also Erekhsha family, one of the families that may have had or may have shared their origins with Iranian Arsacids, or what we call Ashkanian. And interesting is that many of the terms in the Indo-European languages that are associated with archery have to do something with Arash. I mean, you know, it is as if they sound the same and they have the same origin. One of them is Arjuna, for instance. Arjuna is the invincible hero of the Mahabharata. And what happens in that is that he is a great archer. And then we have the idea of Parthians. And we knew that Arjuna was also called Partha in Mahabharata. And Partha is a name that sounds just like Parthian. And we do know that, for instance, Ashkanians, all of them claim to have descended from the from Arash. And we also know that they were great in archery. And their Parthian shot, I mean, on the horseback, they shoot back. And it is famous that it was one of the greatest thing that they did in the war and made them victorious in many battles. And then we have the terms archery and many other terms that have to do with this. So what it tells us is that the myth of Arash, as some other people have also argued, is an Indo-Iranian myth rather than an Iranian myth. And it goes back to a shared origin in which this figure was the great archer who achieved great things. But even in that sense, what we see is also what I can call an agricultural myth, because what happens is that Frasiad or Afrasiab was the demon of drought. And what happens is that Arash is helped by a goddess, by Svandormaz, the goddess of earth, to be able to make the special bow and arrow that can travel so far. So it is as if Svandormaz, who according to some reports had been betrothed to Frasiad, to the demon of drought, has decided to separate from this evil husband of drought and goes to Arash and to Manucher and help them create this particular bow and arrow in order to determine the borders of Iran and bring fertility to the lands that Svandormaz represents. So I have discussed the details of this myth in my writing, but it's important to know that the myth developed or was repurposed gradually to become the celebration of the Parthians in the Iranian tradition. In the Biruni story, which is the only one, the longest one that has survived, Arash is also associated with the Svandormaz Khan or the most Mardiran or most Diran festivity. This is a period in which women can find or choose their own husband, and married women get gifts from their husbands. But what is important, again, we have this story of Svandormaz. This time she is referred to as an angel coming to help Arash. Apart from that, what we see is that he also appears in Tabari, but in Tabari he survives and he becomes the leader of the archers in the Iranian army, which is important because it tells you another layer of myth that talks about the joining of the Parthians to the bulk of Iranian peoples that work together to create the idea of Iran. And also we have allusions to the Shahnameh. In the Shahnameh, we have allusions to Arash. Never directly, we don't have the story, but what happens is that people refer to Arash later in periods. For instance, one of the famous stories is the story of Khosrow Parviz and Bahram Chubin, in which Bahram Chubin claims to be the descendant of Arash. And also we have references to allusions in Vaisoromi. So he does appear here and there, but never in full. And again, as I mentioned, he does not have a section of the Shahnameh dedicated to him. And that is why, one of the reasons why he was nearly forgotten. Until the 19th century, when we see the name appearing in some of the works of Iranian scholars, Western Iranian scholars. And then in the 20th century, we see Yar Shater providing his brief account, which triggered some interest. During that period, what we do know is that Kaveh, the one who goes against the hawk, had become a very important figure in Iranian culture. And basically because he was a working class figure, working class hero. And we do know that Kaveh became the father of a line of Iranian heroes in the Shahnameh, the Gudarzi families. And we know that Kaveh was important as the person who first stood against Zahak. But we do know that when Fereydun appears, it is as if Kaveh becomes nothing. Kaveh is not mentioned anymore in the Shahnameh when Fereydun appears. But later we learn that his sons became the heroes of Iranian, the western side of Iran. So why Arash? Kaveh was important, but Arash was again something that the Iranians could bring to make him the hero of people rather than the hero of the king. He is an old archer in the story, and he appears and he does the job. And the job is not for a king particularly. It seems to be for saving people, because Iranians are under siege and they can't do anything against the Turanians. So again, why Arash became important was because of the political culture, which was focused on finding heroes who were not the heroes of the king, but the heroes of people, or the heroes of the mother Iran. That is why one of the first cultural products that picked up Yar Shater's story and turned it into a memorable poem, a great modernist poem, was also a leftist writer, Siavash Kasrai. But this leftist writer was one of those who is almost loved by everybody because he is not too radical in his visions and he celebrates Iranian figures. And Arash the Archer remained very important in the Iranian culture. Beyzai says that he was inspired to write about Arash by reading that poem and by reading Yar Shater's brief story. And the reason was simple. He says that when I read Arash the Archer, I realized that the depiction of the hero was something very straightforward. It was as if the people just give birth to their heroes very easily. Nothing happens. And then he becomes the hero and he goes. Chon sadaf as sine birun dad. So gave him, it was as if people are compared with a shell, they give us the pearl, the hero, out very easily. Beyzai said that based on my knowledge, I knew that the heroes always have a complicated relationship with the people around them, with the kings around them, with the people around them. They always have issues. And those issues cause vicissitudes in the lives of heroes that gradually builds that hero and turns them into a special figure. And again, another thing was that Beyzai believed that heroes are not born. And one of the issues of many of the epics or romances is that heroes are born and they are expected to come to save people. And this idea, this template of heroes are expected to come in future and save us has remained with us and has become an excuse almost for many of us not to do anything and wait for heroes, whether outside heroes or inside heroes, to do something for us and not to do something ourselves. And Beyzai tries to question all of this in Arash, his recitation play. He originally wrote this play when he was 19 years or 18 years old, and he was in the last year of high school. And the play has its own problems, has a deep sense of worry or a deep sense of despair, youthful despair in that. But the language is special. And when you go deep into the play, so if you read it quickly, you may even dismiss it. But if you read it carefully, gradually it begins to evolve and layers after layers of ideas come out of the play. And this was something that has been discovered by many Iranian directors. The play has been performed several times. Most recently, we had a reading of it 5-6 months ago, and people have read it in different ways. But in any case, some people have celebrated the ideals of heroism, and some people have noticed that Beizai is questioning. Not that he hates heroes, he actually likes heroes, but he questions the way heroes are depicted and expected to save people. And he creates a dialogue between different discourses of the period in his Arash. Let's see what happens in the play. One of the first things that happens in the play is that he highlights the difficult relationship of the hero and his or her people. And then he questions the hero. Is the hero of the people or the hero of the king? In the story of the Arash, Arash is not a born hero. Arash is a hero who is born out of hardship. He is just a normal person. He's actually just a shepherd who has been drafted into Iranian army as a groom of a stable. And when he appears in that role, he gradually learns about the conflicting discourses of how things work. And in one particular moment when Iranian army is under the siege, he is sent to the court of Turanian king because he knows the language of Turan in order to take a message. And the message is about the shooting. And what happens is that the Turanian king, in order to ridicule him, or ridicule Iranians, tell him that you should shoot the arrow. So that's the idea. And because they know that he is not an archer, he is not a hero, and he can't do any sort of great things. And what is important here is that in this scene, the scene in which Arash faces the Turanian king, Humman is present, and Humman is the hero of the king. Humman used to be a hero of the Iranian camp, but what has happened now is that he has just joined the victor's side. And he says that I fight for the person who is victorious. So the Beizai's argument is that the hero of the king is the hero of the power. The moment that the power shifts, he joins that power. But the hero of the people is the hero who stands against the king or against any enemy when the time requires it, as we see, for instance, in the case of Rostam in some cases. So being able to speak truth to power is one of the signs of heroism for Beizai. And this does not come from a person who has been fed by the rulers. This comes from a person who has been fed by people, who has always been among people and actually served people in different functions before becoming a hero. So the idea of in-betweenness is again important. In Beizai, always the hero is a marginalized person. In a way, what happens is that when you are marginalized, you realize that something is wrong with the culture and you try to change it. And if you are determined enough, in long term, you produce new ideas or new systems, and then you become the hero of that new system, or you are considered to be the hero of that new system. So in Arash's case, what happens is that Arash is ridiculed by the Turanians, and they send him to shoot the arrow. They say the only person who is allowed to shoot the arrow is Arash. Therefore, he's hated by his own countrymen because they think that he is a betrayer and because they think that he has actually made the plan himself to shoot the arrow, so to ridicule Iranians more. So he's hated by Iranians and ridiculed by Turanians. He becomes cornered. He's ostracized by everyone. And this figure of marginalized individuality tries to figure out what he should do in this context. Can he die? No, then he will be blamed for other things. So gradually he comes to the conclusion that now that I am cornered, the only thing that I can do is to shoot the arrow. Beizai also creates another figure, which is Kashvat. Kashvat is the grandson of Kaveh. So Beizai brings the leftist tradition, not the left, radical left tradition, the leftist tradition that he believes exists and may have some claim to heroism, of the working class heroes. Do remember that Beyzai's politics is not left. It has never been left. But he has the potential of talking for people, which brings some leftist ideas into his writings without making him leftist. And Keshvad is that figure. So Keshvad is the person who comes to Arash and it says that when you shoot the arrow, people are always going to wait for another hero and they don't do anything. And if you shoot the arrow, if the foreign tyrants go, another tyrant will rule us. So the only thing that you can do is to not to shoot the arrow for people to realize what to do themselves. So this is his argument. So Keshvad is asked to shoot the arrow. He says no before the Turanian's decree of Arash shooting the arrow. Keshvad comes to Arash trying to convince him not to shoot the arrow. But because Arash, because he's just fed up with life and fed up with whatever what has happened, just wants to commit suicide. But then he hates committing suicide. So in the process, he decides just to shoot the arrow to see what will happen. And then when he leaves the Iranian and Turanian camps, he starts climbing Elbrus. And this becomes one of the most significant aspects of the play, written by a person who was 19. It becomes an expressionistic story, expressionistic quest of individuation in which he is in dialogue with the shadows of his darker self, shadows, and the other figures who have influenced his mind. All right. So, for instance, there is a father figure appearing, and that father figure may suggest Mithra. And another figure appears, and these divine figures appear to negotiate things with Arash. And Arash, as he climbs, he becomes more and more determined. So the marginalized figure in quest for belonging and in quest for recognition. The term of belonging and recognition that I use very quickly here are very significant terms. Because in Beyzai's works, or my reading of Beyzai's works, the quest for belonging is central. And psychologically speaking, if you look at our life, is that we are always in quest for belonging. And in order to achieve belonging, we try to gain or obtain qualities that makes us recognizable, make us achieve self-recognition and recognition by others. So in the process of climbing the Elbrus Mountains, Arash gradually tries to see how he can belong, whether he can belong to his countrymen that he really loves, or how should he prove that he is not one of the Turanians. And he comes to the conclusion that the best thing is to just put his life into that arrow. And as he climbs, he's just doubtful. He knows that the shadow comes and tells him that if you shoot, the arrow drops in front of your feet. It doesn't go anywhere. But the determination gradually makes him stronger and stronger until he gets to the top of the mountain and he shoots and he becomes a legend. So for Beyzai, the quest for belonging of a marginalized person who has special cognitive or physical abilities gradually turns him into a hero. Arash is strong physically, but not because he was a champion, but because he had worked all his life as a shepherd. He's a hardened man, all right? And he has also worked with heavy horses and delivering baby horses and other things. In a way, he's a strong, but he doesn't know what he has. So what happens in this case is that hard work has made him strong. And the moment of history when he's under pressure and marginalized by all sides gradually turns him into a hero. In his desire to achieve recognition and prove that he is not a person who has betrayed his country, he becomes the hero that he is. But the point is that Beyzai again questions this heroism, saying that a people who need hero are a poor people. They can never achieve citizenship because they are always waiting for somebody else to save them. Okay? So this was Arash. I'm not going to deal with this one, but remember that Beyzai's puppet plays, which were written in 1961 and 1962, and they were performed at the same time, also deal with heroes and ask very important questions. And the most important question that it asks is that the hero is tired of becoming a hero. This is a puppet play. So they are puppets. But gradually the puppets achieve individuation and become individuals. And it is reflected in the form too. And originally they just move like puppets. And then later what happens is that they begin to move as human beings. And what is important is that he does not kill the demon, because he decides that the demon is not actually a demon. He is a marginalized person that the dominant discourses have turned into this demon. They have demonized him. So the discourse of demonization is something that is questioned in that play. But at the same time, what happens in this play is that the girl realizes that she has always been a damsel in distress or object of a quest, and she wants to be a character of herself. So she also begins to change and become a human being. And the black also decides that I have either been a demon or I have been a jester. I don't want to be that. I just want to be a normal person or a hero. Why not? And you see that in this play, gradually all the puppets begin to become something else, become human. They make mistakes, sometimes grave mistakes, actually in this play. But what is important is that a person who makes decision and ultimately becomes a citizen. And it also asks questions about authoritarian authorship and also about leadership, religion. Why? Because outside this play, we have a narrator, we have a puppeteer who tries to force them to behave in a particular way, but they don't do that. They gradually transcend the roles that have been imposed by them. And the way Beysai arranges this change, gradual change, is that it tells how dominant discourses form our mind and how we can resist them in order to become what is not expected for us, and then make our own decisions rather than be forced into decisions by dominant discourses that make us imitate them or make us behave in a particular way. So in a way, he's questioning mass mentality for critical thinking and individuation. Okay, the next play that Beysai wrote. So up to now, he has dealt with mythic hero. Then he has dealt with folk hero in the puppet tradition. Now he goes to the pre-moment of modernity, to Zurkhane tradition, and deals with the actual wrestler, the champion of the Ayyari, Javanmardi, and Pahlavani tradition that we knew about up to the beginning of 20th century. It has been well recorded, and there are many writings about them. The source that he uses here, it is important, is that is cousin, who was much older than he was one of the first, well, actually the first. He was the first scholar who worked on the Zurkhane tradition, and his Beysai Kashani, and his book has remained one of the main sources to study the Zurkhane tradition. So does Pahlavan Akbar has a very special title. It says Pahlavan Akbar Mimirat. And that Mimirat, is a tense in Persian that can refer to always, can refer to future, right? But what is important is that it can also refer to right now. Mimirat, nowadays we use darat mimirat, right? But we know that we can use that in Persian. So mimirat has three senses in Persian: right now, always, future. So in a way, by using that title, Beysai is saying that hero, that type of hero, which is actually the most important and the best type of hero, is doomed to die in this culture. Why? Because this culture is expecting too much, is creating a hero to crush it. Do remember that some people compare Pahlavan Akbar with Takhti. And we do know that Takhti was killed or killed himself. We don't know. I don't want to get into that. 2 years, or 1 year actually, 1 year after the performance of this play. So the play was written in 1963, but it was first performed in 1965 to 1966, the performance. So let's look at the figures of the Zurkhane. In the Zurkhane tradition, we have seven levels of development which echo some aspects of Mithraism, the seven Mithraic levels. So Noche is a boy of probably between the age of 14 and 18. He's a novice, a trainee who has just joined Zurkhane. And نوخاسته, probably a youth of between 18 and 25, a newly rising novice of good wrestling ability, ready for initiation. A pahlavan is a hero of probably between the age of 25 to 40, 35, is the main champion. Okay? A young man who has been initiated due to his character and skills in all Zulkhane exercise. So I have used the term initiated here, because the initiation in Zulkhane is not just learning about the wrestling and about the techniques of Zulkhane. It is also about a cult, a type of behavior and attitude, a kind of compassionate, sacrificial attitude, which is all should always be there to support people. Whether they do it or not is another question, okay? In all Zulkhane exercises, then we have Kohne Savar. Kohne Savar, probably a person between the age of 35 and 50. Then we have Pishkespat, 45 to 55, 60. And we go down, you see, we have seven layers. So Pishkespat, a senior pahlavan with an established reputation as a trainer and guide. Sahib Zarb, a senior pahlavan. So we get to Sahib Zarb. Sahib Zarb and Sahib Zang are usually peers. And peer is a person who also has a spiritual quality and acts as a spiritual guide for the, supposed to act as a spiritual guide and leader for the other figures. Among these seven figures, we do know that the middle four or the middle three are the most important one when it comes to their role in the public space, in the way they fulfill purposes. They can be on the side of power, or they can be on the side of a people. Of course, by power, I don't want just mean the state. In Iran, the power has always been divided in the past between the clergy and the court. So this figure, because of the great street presence that they have, or because of their physical power, they can play important roles. They can become instrument of tyranny, they can become instrument of support, they can become rebel, depending on the role that they come to play in society. And I don't want to get to the political side of the thing, but they have always played a role, okay? Beyzai makes a journey to the origin of the terms Javanmard, Ayyar, and Pahlavan. Javanmard is a general term belonging to all Javanmardi calls. Ayyar is the person most associated with going around secretly, like a ninja type of figure, who is a trickster, clever, and does Pahlavani things as well. So an Ayyar is always a Javanmard, is supposed to be, and he may be a Pahlavan or not. In most cases, they are not Pahlavans. They are special. They have special skills, like being able, for instance, to make a very good tunnel under the ground, like being able, for instance, to climb castles and enter the castles. So some Pahlavans have Ayyari qualities, but not all Ayyars have Pahlavani qualities, because Pahlavan is supposed to be also very powerful in direct single combat. So these figures were imitator, or many of the tough guys claimed to have come from the same tradition, but in reality, this was not the case, as we all know, okay? Beyzai salvages the concept of Javanmard, Ayyar, and Pahlavan from the pitfalls of contemporary lumpen cults of the POSCO era. So the POSCO era and the type of the guys that had claimed to be the representative or the remnants of these heroes are the points of question here. So instead of going to them to depict them negatively or positively, Beyzai goes to the origin and tries to show what type of character really represents the ideals of Javanmardi, Ayyari, and Pahlavani, all right? And this figure is what we call Akbar. So Akbar in this story is an intellectually and physically gifted champion. Remember that many of the great champions of heroism or pahlavans were also poets. So they were not just single figures of going around wrestling and beating people up. And we have Puryai Vali as the great example. And Puryai Vali is used by Beyzai as one of the role models based on whom he has created Akbar. All right. So who is Akbar? Again, we go to the idea of the marginalized figure. Akbar is a lost child. During a journey, He loses his mother at the age of 9 or 10. He's picked up by nomads. He grows among nomads, and he's very powerful, and the nomads like his work. But what happens is that he falls in love, and then he's rejected because people say that you are impure blood. They don't know about his origin, and they claim that you are probably a bastard, for instance. And this causes a fight between him and the chief's son, and he beats him up. And after that, what happens is that he's beaten by the nomads, and he's attached to the body of a horse and dragged on the ground after he's beaten with tied hands, and he suffers. And then what we see is that he is toughened by life and hard work. And hard work is essential here. And we are talking about heavy work that he does. And because of some maybe good genes, he becomes very powerful and also exercises. So ultimately, he's picked up by a peer. So the peer finds him when he was beating up bandits in the roads in order to stop them from attacking people and attacking caravans. So the peer brings him to the city, trains him as a wrestler, and he sees that he's already very compassionate and supportive and sympathetic. He's already a Robin Hood type of guy, right? So he trains him in the givens of the Zulkhana tradition, and he becomes Akbar. So he defeats everybody in wrestling. He becomes the champion of the city. But then from the beginning, he has this problem with authority. He hates authority. He has this great desire for belonging, and he wants people to love him. And he has achieved the recognition in order to become that. And partly in his soliloquies that are some of the most beautiful, linguistically speaking, soliloquies of the Persian drama, we see how he talks about why he became a great champion, why he beat up the bandits. It was primarily because he wanted to be loved. He wanted his story to be heard by the girl that he loved. So Beyzai makes love the center of this. But this love is not just a simple love of crazy person, romantic. It is also the love of a person for a people who have rejected him. And that love is important because, again, it places Akbar in the same position as Arash. He loves the people that have rejected him, and he wants to prove to them that he is good. He's the force of good. So he identifies with the poor. And again, one of the closest friend in the play that he has is a Zoroastrian wine seller. So Beyzai was one of the first people who focused on the idea of the marginalized in Iranian society. And this marginalized could be a person from another ethnic background, a person from another religious background, or it can be an orphan, or it can be a woman who in a patriarchal society cannot really do the things that she is capable of doing. Therefore, his anti-establishment and sacrificial in whatever he does, for instance, is one of the things that happens in the story. When the horse of a miller dies, he goes and for a week just he turns the heavy stone of the mill instead of the horse. So that is the type of power that we are talking about. And then in a very special moment, we have the story of Puryaye Badi created in the story of this. In this case, the mother appears. So this is the mother appears and prays for his son to defeat Pahlavan Akbar. And Pahlavan Akbar is present. He also likes music, another aspect of the character that Beyzai pays attention to. He likes wine, he's secular, and at the same time, he identifies with the Zoroastrian. He identifies with the marginalized. He doesn't have any religion, but he identified with the marginalized Zoroastrian whose district has been completely destroyed, by the way. So here he gives some water to the mother, and he says that, "Mother, Akbar is not going to defeat your son." So this is the promise that he has made. But he doesn't know how to fulfill that promise. And as he's thinking about how to fulfill that promise so that it becomes believable, and we see scenes of encounter in which Haydar, the other guy, that he feels as if this other guy is his brother, his lost brother. That is what he is feeling. So let me clarify the point. When he hears the mother He feels that this woman is familiar, but he doesn't know, he's not sure. And then the mother refers to losing her first son. And again, this brings something into his mind. And this triggers the idea of, this might be my mother and Haydar my brother. Haydar is very rude. When they face each other in front of the peer, and the peer tells them that you have to wrestle with compassion rather than with hatred, Akbar doesn't want to be rude to him, but Haydar is rude because he just wants to push himself to be able to fight with Akbar. And it's interesting that when a girl comes to pray for Haydar, Akbar looks at her and he thinks that she looks like the girl that he loved in among the nomads. So again, two forces, two women draw him in, one for love of the family, mother, and one for the love of the future love, marriage, fertility, continuity. But Akbar is trapped within a defeatist perspective. He doesn't want to be defeated by Haydar so that it sounds as if he has shown it. In a way, he says it is impossible to be defeated based on a pretension. So if I do it, people will know that I have done it. And then he compares himself with Puryaye Vali, saying that if Puryaye Vali wanted to do a better job, he should have done it in a way that nobody would have known. But everybody knows that Puryaye Vali consciously decided to be defeated. In any case, Akbar is being followed by this shadow, by this shadowy figure, which seems to come from his unconscious. This double, which is ever present, is the force of doubt, hesitation, and self-hatred that tells him that despite whatever you have achieved, you are no good, and therefore you don't deserve the position that you have. And that figure is always around, but does not dare to come forward. But the moment that Akbar decides that my life is useless, and he sits down and puts his kameh down, puts his mashdi down, sword down, turns his back, and the man comes and kills him. So is he an assassin? Is he his double? It can be both. The fact is that it can be a bandit who has been chasing him to find an opportunity to kill him, because he has been the greatest enemy of bandits and the greatest enemy of the men of the ruler. But what is important is that he can defeat, he can kill Akbar, because Akbar has just decided to die. In a way, his double has overtaken him. The double of despair in him, the double that hates him, the double of hate, self-hatred, has made him weak enough, or has made him forget about life and put aside. So this death drive, in my chapter, I discuss it in Freudian terms and Jungian terms. This death drive convinces him that he shouldn't defend himself. But what happens is that when Akbar dies, the two policemen come and take his clothing, and they blame the Zoroastrian for killing him. So it's a very bitter and tragic end. It's one of the important things that happened in Iranian culture when this play was written, read by many, and then was performed in 1965 and 1966. Why? Because it influenced many other later works. So Beyzai's Pahlavan-centered plays, 1959 to 1963, which were performed very successfully. I mean, Pahlavan Akbar was performed in 1965. And Sadegh Chubak's Tangsir led to the rise of three new templates in Iranian cinema. So nobody has ever talked about this template gradually evolving after Tangsir and after Beyzai's Pahlavan-centered heroes. One of them is Pahlavans and Ayyars themselves. Remember that Iranian cinema had become obsessed with the thugs, with the streetwise tough guys who were depicted as having heroic qualities, by the way. But Pahlavans and Ayyars themselves were absent. But after Beyzai's works, they became one of the major subjects of several films that appeared later. The other figure is the marginalized city tough guy who rose against unscrupulous lower or upper class rivals or oppressors. The best example is Qaysar. Yeah, before that we had Golagha, of course, there was another one. But Qaysar is a top figure for that. He rises, so he's a rebel and he dies, or he's arrested, or he's, in a way he suffers. So again, he's a tragic figure. And the last one is the rebellious village types fighting against corrupt elites like Sadık Korda, like Tangsir. So we have examples of that figure, some of them played by Behruz Usuvi. But if you look down, you see that all of these appeared after Beyzai's work. So we have Ali Hatemiz Baba Shamad, we have Cyrus Afhamiz Pahlavan Nayeb, which was a TV series, very popular, by the way. And then we have Kaysar and many other films that were created in the same tradition. And this was my talk, but it's always difficult to decide what to include and what not to include. Therefore, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Saeed, very much. That was absolutely fascinating. I like the way that the written word is represented, as it were, in film as well, the interaction between the two media. Very interesting. What I was interested in, my familiarity with Javan Mahdi is older, but in the more modern period, the only reference to Javan Mahdi and Lu Tihon, and this is Dosha Kol, which of course came out, you know, originally, right? And then it became into a film. And I wonder what was the relationship. How does that fit into the model?
One of the sources that inspired Beyzai for that play, for Pahlavan Akbar, was Dosha Kol, in fact.
Okay.
Because Dosha Kol is also a tragic figure. And it is, in Sadık Hidayat, it becomes the end of a type of figure that can no longer exist. So Dosha Kol can no longer exist. And we know that Rostam, Kaka Rostam, is actually a double. So a double, beside being an individual, a person, is the double of, the negative double of Dosha Kol.
Yeah.
And both of them have to die. In a way.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. I have a question here. A fantastic talk. Could you please address the tension between the Fokoli and Mahmali characters?
All right. So this is a very early tension that began to evolve in the 1910s, actually. And one of the best places in which we have the figure of, so originally the figure of Fokoli was depicted as an intellectual in the works of Fekri and Mahmudi, a figure who has positive qualities, who is West educated and has come back with great ideas. But gradually what we see that this figure began to become a negative figure who is only imitating the West. And the way he carries himself and behaves is far from the way that is ideal for Iranian type. So it began to evolve in Iranian plays, and gradually it became the opposite of the Luti, right? So both of them had modern qualities, of course, because the Luti that we see in the 1940s and 1950s is very different from the Luti that existed before. They wear suits, they have Kolam Ahmadi, which was not there in the past. So they are both modern in one way or another, but one of them seems to, especially the Luti type rather than the Laut type, the Luti type becomes the authentic type of the streetwise guy. And the other type, the Fokoli, is only after women, after making trouble, after showing off and not real. So Fokoli and Dashmashti or Luti gradually became opposites. It is only in Bahram Beyzai's Ragbar, Downpour, later made in 1971, in which both figures come to have to show their good and bad qualities. And it's an important film exactly for that purpose. But many people before, for instance, we have Madani himself, Madani, the person who wrote Esmal Dar New York, also uses the figure of Jigulu or Fokoli in Esmal Dar Hindustan. And it is interesting that he shows their similarities. In a way, both of them are street people. Of course, we know that Fokoli has the qualities of dandy. So the figure of dandy has negative and positive qualities. But in the Iranian Fokoli type, for a long period, it was only the negative thing that was emphasized. But in Madani and some other people, gradually it was shown as both in the negative light and the positive light. But you know, the discussion is a big discussion. So whoever asked the question, if they contact me, I can discuss it in details. It's a huge subject. You can write a book about it. But we see these vicissitudes, ups and downs of the Fokoli and Luti being praised as hero or as a villain, depending on the film or the period.
Terrific, Saeed. Thank you so very much. I want to thank all of our attendees as well. I'm sure the questioners can get right back to you at the University of St. Andrews if they have any points of detail or other informational sorts of questions they'd like to address to you. Saeed, once again, thank you very much. And thank you to our audience for their participation. And good evening, good afternoon, good morning, depending upon where you are. And once again, happy Nowruz, happy Persian New Year.
Thank you very much.
From Edinburgh and London and St. Andrews.
Same.